De la revolución del mundo.
Justice by any means
necessary. This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of the Socialism 2024 program. You can hear more recordings from the conference by subscribing to the Socialism Conference podcast feed. Many video recordings are also available at socialismconference.org. If you enjoy these recordings, you should join us at Socialism 2025, which will be held in Chicago next summer, July 3rd through the 6th, 2025. If you are ready to put ideas into action and get organized with others from across the country and the world, make a plan with your organization and your friends to come to the Socialism Conference.
All right. So I wanted to thank you all for joining us today in our discussion on U.S. sanctions on Cuba and the Global South here at the Socialism 2024 Conference at the Hyatt Regency in Chicago. My name is Alex Jimenez. My pronouns are he, him, and I'm here on behalf of the Chicago-Cuba Coalition to facilitate today's session. So, thanks again for coming, and I wanted to introduce our esteemed panelists here today. First, Professor August Nymphs, Professor of Political Science and African-American Studies at the University of Minnesota, as well as co-founder of the Minnesota-Cuba Committee and author of The Ballot, The Streets Are Both, From Marx and Engels to Lenin and the October Revolution. And his book can actually be found outside on the Chicago-Cuba Coalition table. Also, we have Oscar Alvarez. Oscar, how you doing? He's a Cuban-American and the former president of the Young Democratic Socialists of America at FIU in Miami. And also Dr. Helen Yaffe. Hi, Dr. Yaffe. Senior lecturer in economic and social history at the University of Glasgow, specializing in Cuban and Latin American development. She is the author of We Are Cuba, How a Revolutionary People Have Survived in a Post-Soviet World, and Che Guevara, The Economics of Revolution. Helen has co-produced the documentaries Cuba's Life Task, Combating Climate Change about Cuba's Long-Term Plan for Climate Change Adaptation, and Cuba and COVID-19 Public Health, Science, and Solidarity about Cuba's response to the pandemic in the first year. Both are available on YouTube. So thanks again. Thank you all for joining us today. And I just kind of wanted to open it up to the first question to all of you, asking how you each got involved in advocating for the end of the blockade on Cuba and what progress, if any, has been made for your respective missions since it was imposed. And whoever would like to go first. August, if you would like to start.
Well, thanks very much, Alex, and thanks very much to the Cuba Coalition for inviting me to be a part of the program. It's a real honor and a privilege. I've been doing Cuba solidarity work consistently since 1990 when we organized in Minnesota the Minnesota-Cuba Committee. It was in response to the defeat that the Sandinistas had suffered in the elections there. And most of us who were doing solidarity work around Latin America and so on realized that Cuba needed attention. And we came together and formed at the national level and at the local level a committee that was doing solidarity work throughout the entire country. My attachment or my embrace of the Cuban Revolution actually goes way back when I was a senior in high school when the Cuban Revolution happened. And I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, and New Orleans had a very close affinity and connections with Cuba. And as soon as I heard about the revolution, I grabbed onto it. I embraced it, and I've always been inspired by it. And that really, really got off the ground when I visited Africa for the first time and lived in Tanzania in 1969 and 1970. And I saw how much the Cuban Revolution meant to the African liberation movement. So that really sealed my embrace of the Cuban Revolution. And so I've been doing Cuban solidarity work ever since.
Thank you, Oscar or Helen, if you'd like to go next.
I can go. First off, thank you so much for having me on this panel. I'll just introduce myself again. Hi, comrades. My name is Oscar. I go by he, him, and I'm a Cuban-American student at Florida International University, and I've been a member of the Young Democratic Socialist of America chapter at FIU since 2020. I'm also a member of the Reform and Revolution Caucus, which is a Marxist caucus within DSA. So both sides of my family are Cuban. They're both anti-communists. They came to Miami in the 1980s as teenagers, and they both studied, became business owners. My grandfather, he's a brilliant yet stubborn man whose wine-filled rants always ended condemning Castro and the revolution. But, you know, we'd play dominoes till the sun comes up. I was never very politicized until 2020 during the BLM uprisings, our mismanagement of COVID, and the second Bernie campaign, where I took the time that summer to really develop myself, learn more about Marxism, imperialism, and the gains of the revolution for a vast majority of Cuban farmers and peasants. And upon joining YDSA at FIU my freshman year, I did more studying on the role of the CIA, our imperialist foreign policy overall, and just it became more unabashedly vocal about the sanctions. I wanted to make sure that our chapter was providing those educational resources on the ways that U.S. has undermined Cuba's sovereignty and their just struggle against imperialism and towards socialism. Of course, some students and conservative influencers were not fond of our work as open socialists in Miami, but we remain steadfast in our commitment to advancing and, of course, expanding the revolution here. And as president, our chapter established contact with the Miami Coalition to End the U.S. Blockade of Cuba, where we coordinated several collaborative film screenings on subjects like Cuba's advancements in queer liberation and environmentalism. And one of them was actually a film by Dr. Helen Yaffer herself, Cuba's Life Task, which I highly recommend. Most recently, our chapter, along with a united front of organizations, had helped raise over $4,000 to send pacemakers to those in need on the island. And we plan on holding more events, raising class consciousness among students and workers this fall. We'll be primarily organizing around divestment, Palestinian liberation, and its ties to anti-imperialism, as well as housing justice amidst the crisis we are facing in Miami. But I'm really honored and excited to contribute to this panel, help advance the struggle for the liberation of the global South and within a steadily declining U.S. empire. So thank you.
Okay, thank you. I guess it's my turn. I'll start by thanking Julie and everyone who has organized the conference and invited me. It's great to be on this panel with two other great panelists. So I grew up with communist activist parents, so I grew up active, spent my childhood on protests against apartheid, obviously learning about Cuba's contribution to combating apartheid in Angola, defending Angola against the invasion of the apartheid regime. And then when I was 18, I went to live in Cuba with my older sister. And this was in 1995, so not quite, but nearly the worst moment during the special period. And we saw the impact of the US blockade ourselves in terms of scarcity in every sector, in every sort of realm of life. It's not just the scarcity that the global South suffers because of unequal terms of trade, because of hundreds of years of colonialism and imperialism, because of underdevelopment by imperialist powers, but it was worse. So, you know, subsequently studying it, we can say that the US blockade is estimated to have cost Cuba about $15 billion between the revolution, or between when it was introduced and the collapse of the Soviet bloc. Because, of course, it was there. It was a major obstacle, particularly for ambitions. For example, you know, as mentioned, I studied the work of Che Guevara as Minister of Industries and his ambitions to get the most advanced technology into Cuba. And of course, that was obstructed by the US blockade. But at least there was the Soviet bloc, the socialist countries that could provide Cuba with oil, with medicines, with alternative resources. And then when that collapsed, Cuba faced what they called, you know, the double blockade, and it really hit hard. And, you know, just going back to Cuba frequently, I now have family in Cuba. You cannot go to Cuba and not feel the impact of the US blockade and the way that it affects everything. And then obviously as a researcher, as an economic historian, as someone who's an academic, a teacher, every single area which I research for my book, We Are in Cuba. So there's a chapter on biotechnology, there's a chapter on the energy revolution, there's stuff about Cuba's medical internationalism. Through the research that you do, the interviews you do, you realize very concretely how the US blockade has affected Cuba's capacity to advance and to develop in the context of their work in that sector. You know, and as I conclude in We Are Cuba, look what they have been able to achieve. I mean, Cuba has arguably met all of the non-financial, non-economic elements of the UN Sustainable Development Goals, you know, apart from the fact that they're not upheld as a model for development. There is the other question: what could Cuba achieve if it didn't face the US blockade? If we look at how remarkable its achievements are with this asphyxiation, with this suffocating blockade for well over 60 years.
Amazing. Yes, thank you to all of you again. Excited to have you all on to engage in discussions like this. I am really excited to get into today. And like I said, I've been a big fan and admirer of all your works from afar. So first, I wanted to address a question to you, Professor Nimes. Economic sanctions have been tactically imposed by countries worldwide and were at the forefront during the apartheid era in South Africa. Sanctions which the U.S. government staunchly had opposed. However, the State Department has incorporated sanctions as a central tool in their foreign policy and weaponized them against countries they deem a threat to their political agenda. What are your thoughts on the morality and impact of sanctions, and when are they appropriate, if ever? And additionally, given your experience and involvement in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, what are the key differences between the sanctions on Cuba in comparison to the ones imposed on South Africa?
Thanks, Alex. That's an important question in all kinds of ways. And let me respond. I've had the good luck to begin doing anti-apartheid work, divestment, boycott, sanctions work in 1965. When the first major conference took place in the United States to do that work. And the context was the recent imprisonment of Nelson Mandela and his comrades to life in prison. And that was in 1964. And so there was a sense of demoralization within anti-apartheid activists in the United States, in a sense that something had to be done. And so that's how the conference in Washington, D.C. in the spring of 1965, that's the context, that's why it was held. And in hindsight, we didn't see it at the time, but in hindsight, that was the beginning of the movement. And you're absolutely right. This was a movement that was opposed by the rulers of the United States. And so we had to fight and make a case for boycott, sanctions, disinvestment, and so on, against the wishes of the United States. And briefly to answer your question, the basic difference between the South African case and the Cuban case is that we had to have the agreement of civil society in South Africa to carry out boycott, divestment, and the sanctions. We had to have the agreement of civil society within South Africa, for the very moral reason that sanctions, if you think about it, it's a blunt instrument, and it's an indiscriminate collective kind of punishment. And sanctions always disproportionately affect the working class, those at the bottom of society. So the only moral justification we could give in carrying out that campaign is to get the agreement of those at the bottom of society, the working classes, the masses in South Africa. That was crucial. That was very crucial. In the case of Cuba, it's exactly the opposite. The civil society in Cuba is opposed to the sanctions. Washington doesn't have the agreement of the Cuban people to carry, and therefore that's what makes it immoral in a very basic sense. But there's also a political reason too why we had to get the agreement of the masses, civil society within South Africa, because it's a blunt instrument, and it's a collective form of punishment and so on. You're asking people, if you don't get their agreement and so on, then the regime in South Africa can use the campaign and so on to really win support for itself, because the campaign, you're carrying out this collective punishment against South Africa, not making a differentiation and so on. And so the regime tried to on a number of occasions. That's something we had to deal with, was to say that what we were doing was against the will of the South African masses and so on. And I remember at one moment, the Reagan administration, in cooperation with South Africa, brought to the United States a delegation of South African, black South Africans, who were collaborators with the regime, to try to make the case that what we were doing that was opposed by the people of South Africa. And so luckily we had already done our homework. We had gotten the support, the agreement of civil society, especially the African National Congress, played a major role in helping us to be able to do it. So we were able to counter those kinds of lies. And again, without getting that support of civil society within South Africa, you're carrying out a particular set of actions and so on that have the potential of driving the masses into the arms of the state. That's the last thing we wanted to do, and that's why we had to have their agreement. I remember at one moment we learned in a hard kind of way this lesson. In Minnesota, there was a corporation called Controlled Data Corporation, and they were doing business in South Africa. And so our South African Solidarity Committee, decided to have a picket line in front of the plant, and the company responded by saying that the black workers in the plant, it was in the black neighborhood in St. Paul, the black workers in the plant were upset with us that we were picketing their plant, and this was going to threaten their jobs, and that the company claimed that it couldn't protect us if we got out in front. Some of these workers may attack us because we were threatening their jobs with this picket line. And so we decided to call off the picket line because we hadn't prepared. We hadn't done the homework. We hadn't done the educational work within the plant to convince these workers there why indeed it was necessary to have the picket line. So it was an important lesson for us. And from then on, we were very, very conscious to make sure that we had the agreement of civil society within South Africa. Again, that's the opposite, completely the opposite of what's going on in Cuba. Civil society in Cuba is opposed to what Washington is doing. So that's the base. We can come back and discuss more in detail.
Thank you, Professor. That is a very important distinction to note between the two, and getting the agreement of the civil society and the workers is obviously kind of the baseline for that. And talking about the destruction that sanctions can do on a country, I wanted to direct this to you, Dr. Yaffe. Can you hear me? Amazing.
So yes, I can.
You have conducted extensive research on the Cuban economy and the government's approach towards market diversification and financial stability. In your book, We Are Cuba, you touch on the history of underdevelopment due to colonialism in addition to the destruction done by the blockade. You reference earlier a $15 billion loss since it was imposed. Please explain how the PCC, El Partido Comunista de Cuba, has been able to resist seemingly insurmountable obstacles despite a recurring turbulent state of economic instability.
Okay, thanks for that very complicated, multi-dimensional question. I mean, I have to say I'm pleased with this question because I am currently working on a chapter on Cuban democracy. And, you know, it's a big thorny issue. How do you have a situation where Fidel Castro is referred to the dictator by some and the great revolutionary by others? And some say Cuba's a dictatorship and others say it's an example of participatory grassroots democracy. So, you know, I discussed these questions in the chapter and the meaning of democracy and then explain how the Cuban system works and the sort of the political tradition which it's in. So if I say now that it's in the tradition of the Paris Commune, some of you will know what I'm referring to, and the key tenets that political representatives are voted by their peers, there's no self-nomination, they are non-professional, so there's no material incentive, they're not looking to become politicians to get rich. They continue in their initial employment. They are also accountable. So they have to hold meetings with their constituents who voted for them at least every 6 weeks, 6 months. And these meetings can't have in the local area. They can't have more than 120 people. So in some big, densely populated municipalities, they may have to have up to 10 meetings because they're capped to a level where which will allow participation. Other issues are many other issues that I've discussed. But you're asking about this Cuban Communist Party. So I think there are a few key characteristics that I would pull out. And again, we can discuss them more. First of all, the tradition that the Cuban Communist Party is in is the same tradition as the struggle for independence, which was really encapsulated in José Martí's ideas, although there were many others who also fought for independence. And this is the notion not of a, you know, an independent capitalist nation, but independence for Cuba, which meant fighting against Spanish colonialism. And even, you know, José Martí, although they were battling for independence from Spain, warned of the intentions and the possibility of US imperialism falling over Cuba to dominate Cuba, to use it as a launch pad for extending its domination over the Americas. You know, so this, the central to the Cuban revolutionary demand has been the theme of social justice and sovereignty. And sovereignty means control of your natural resources, right? By the people, for the people. So the Communist Party of Cuba, which actually emerges from the merging of the three revolutionary armed groups, which are leading the revolutionary struggle in the 1950s, that's the Movement for the 26th of July, the Revolutionary Directorate, that's Armed Students Movement, and the old Communist Party, which was actually called the Popular Socialist Party at that time, they come together and merge, but they very much stick in that tradition. They stick to those key tenets that for Cuba, socialism is also about sovereignty and social justice. And those are key principles. If you look at some of the guiding kind of documents, the theorizing documents, particularly those that have come out of Cuba since 2011, the guidelines for updating the economic and social system, the documents in 2017 about conceptualizing Cuban socialism, the plan of national development up to 2030, and you look at the list of adjectives that they use to describe, to assert the character of the Cuban socialist state. It is, you know, sovereignty and democracy, social justice. They are in among those adjectives. So those are really key things that the Cuban Communist Party isn't a sort of implanted as a sort of alien or foreign ideology. It's very much appropriated to the Cuban struggle for independence. Then, of course, I've mentioned the revolution of the 1950s. The revolution of the 1950s was a mass participative process. So, you know, there is a caricature of the revolution that it was, you know, 12 middle class white bearded men who in the fighting in the jungles. And actually, that's a total denial of the contribution of thousands of Cubans who participated in the 1950s, whether it was in the rebel army or the underground clandestine movement or the student front or the trade union front, which, you know, was consolidated by 1958, and there's other civil fronts that existed. And, you know, even children whose job was just to, you know, hand out, sneak around with materials or leaflets or notes and so on. Women who would go up to the mountains carrying communiques hidden under their skirts and so on. So mass participation was a key characteristic of the revolution. The revolution, the revolutionary movement was led by free movements who then forged to make this Communist Party. So its character is extremely diverse in terms of the range of people, backgrounds that of people who are involved. And it represents a huge cross-section of Cuban society. And that continues. So immediately after the Cuban Revolution, the Cuban Communist Party doesn't actually officially get named that until 1965. But what they do is set up very quickly the organizations of the masses. So they have some that pre-exist 1959. That's the Students' Federation, which, as I said, you know, had an armed wing and was involved in the revolutionary movement. And they also had the trade union movement, which was purged of its opportunist leadership that had pledged allegiance to Batista the day after his victory and so on. But they also then set up a women's federation. They set up a association for small farmers. They set up the street committees, which were initially for revolutionary vigilance, as Fidel called it, because of bombing and terrorism that they were experiencing on a daily basis at that time. So the organizations of the masses were set up, local council, local government was set up. The idea was, how can we convert the mass participation that we had during the revolutionary process and actually expand it when there isn't the terror of knowing that if you're caught contributing to the revolutionary movement, you'll be brutally killed or detained, which is what happened. 20,000 Cubans who were killed in the most brutal manner under that second dictatorship by Batista. So it's this sort of tradition of participation of democracy and diversity. And, you know, I'm now, I'm in the chapter, I'm talking about how the organs of people's power, the national system of people's power, is set up. And, you know, it's quite hard to write about because it's fascinating and it's so dynamic. So you start writing about how, you know, it was, but then they have this built-in process of perfeccionamiento. So let's constantly evaluate what we're doing, what could be done better, and how we can make improvements. And their notion of improvements is making this political system as decentralized as possible and increasing the level of local participation. So right now in Cuba, they're going through a process of territorial decentralization. The idea is to increase the amount of control that local municipalities, I don't know what that would be in the United States. In Britain, the equivalent is a borough. In Cuba, a municipality, it's a sort of a neighborhood, let's say. And they're decentralizing control of budgets and political decision-making. So within that, in every layer, there are committees that are elected directly, secret ballot among the population, and a rotating sort of leadership of these. So most Cubans have some experience of governance, of decision making, of responsibility, of accountability. It's a fascinating process. But you might say, well, I asked you about the Cuban Communist Party and you're telling me about, you know, the local elections. But the two are entwined because, interestingly, we're constantly told that Cuba is a one-party state. And I'm not going to deny that Cuba is a one-party state, but it has no party elections because one of those tenets of the Cuban electoral system is that people do not stand as a member of the Communist Party. They, in fact, the Communist Party is not allowed to get involved in the electoral process. So they do have half of the people going into the National Assembly, previously the provincial assemblies, until they were disbanded recently. and in the municipal assemblies. They represent the organizations of the masses, the political organizations. They even have religious representatives who have seats put aside. The Cuban Communist Party and the Young Communist League is not allowed to participate in that process. So what you have is a separation in notion between the act of government and the running of the state and the role of the Communist Party, which is to be an ideological and political leadership. And you know, unashamedly political, because the function of the state is to, you know, drive forward the socialist development program. So, you know, in terms of your question, how have the Communist Party managed to get through this, like, unbelievably difficult, challenging experiences, particularly in the last few years since, say, 2019, but earlier in the period I talked about, the special period after the collapse of the Soviet bloc, it's because the communist people is extremely representative of the population, and it has a constant dialogue and communication with the population. So in Cuba, not anyone can be a member of the Communist Party, as I believe it was in most of the, in the USSR and the socialist countries. So if everyone can be and you choose not to, then the scrutiny is, well, what's wrong with you? Are you reactionary? Why don't you join the Communist Party? In Cuba, it is a privilege, and a, you know, and a sort of, your credentials for joining are that you are the hardest working, you are the most prepared to sacrifice, you are the best to represent your community and, you know, the national values of a socialist state. So these are very important things. When you look at moments of crisis, one of the things you'll note in the internal debate is always the question about, is the relationship between the Communist Party and the people strong enough? What can we do to strengthen it? And that is a current debate underway in Cuba. But it's also something that emerged in the late 1980s when it, you know, just precede, it was one of the discussions preceding a period known as rectification. The long name was the rectification of errors and negative tendencies. And the Communist Party had a congress and they said, we have two problems. One is the separation of the leadership of the Communist Party from the rank and file. And two is, you know, inefficient, we're too dependent, like inefficient economic issues. So what they did in that congress is they deferred, they stopped the congress halfway through and they said, we need to know what the workers, what the, you know, Cuban people think are the real, the roots of these problems and what they are, what would they would propose as the solution. So they've deferred the Congress, I think, for 4 months and set up workers' parliaments all over the country. 85,000 meetings took place. You know, most workers in Cuba participated in one of these debates. And then after these suggestions, comments, criticisms were analysed, they went back to the deferred Congress of the Communist Party and they introduced a change in the economic direction of the country, this rectification. So what you see there is it's a Communist Party that has the capacity to mobilise the population, to mobilise the vanguard of the population, the workers, and to listen and engage in a dialogue. And as long as it has that capacity, then the Communist Party of Cuba will remain strong and relevant and popular as well.
Amazing, Dr. Yaffe. Yeah, thank you especially for touching on even the current processes of the municipal and provincial you know, delegations and how they influence the National Assembly and really the grassroots participation that they've had in, you know, what Fidel had termed revolutionary vigilance after the bombing of the plazas and the creation of a lot of groups like the CDR and that carry out literacy, you know, campaigns and vaccination campaigns and help kind of community presence and really helping that kind of representative process play out on the island. So I thank you for touching on that. Oscar, I wanted to pose this next question to you. We know that oftentimes newer, younger generations of Cubans have a different relationship to the revolution than their elders. or former generations. How does this temporal distance from the revolution, or how has this temporal distance from the revolution shaped younger Cubans' understanding of its benefits and its flaws? And additionally, what impact has social media had on this perception?
For sure. So, yeah, this temporal distance has had a significant shift. The political conditions, not only on the island, but among the diaspora and within the United States, has had a huge effect on how people view Cuba, their perceptions of the revolution as it has developed, and of course, the political crises and economic crises that is currently faced, or is currently facing and has faced in response or due to the sanctions. But I think speaking personally from my own conditions, born and raised in Miami, Miami-Dade County especially, which is the most Cuban county in the United States, the largest demographic of Cuban Americans, it is a stronghold for, you know, the right-wing exile community. You know, they've had political and, you know, media influence in terms of shaping the perceptions, not only among the youth, but among themselves as well. There's, of course, the pro-bloqueo exile community that has had, you know, numerous positions within, you know, as elected officials within certain committees in Congress, but also in influencing how people view the revolution as it currently stands. And I think I want to broaden it a little bit, because I feel like the question of the sanctions themselves, I think that because it should be something so uncontroversial, you know, it should be something that, as August Nunes has mentioned, is a collective punishment. You know, these sanctions have had not only repercussions to the people on the island, but the diaspora themselves and the relations that they can have with them, their ability to have security and their family be able to prosper within the island. And so these are, you know, humanitarian conditions or humanitarian arguments that must be made to a broad swath of the Cuban American community, and especially among the youth, in terms of how we build this broad front, especially within the conditions, like I mentioned, in Miami, to be able to really push back against this narrative that this is a monolithic demand or democratic mandate on the part of our politicians of what the Cuban community wants. Like we mentioned, the Cubans on the island, the masses, are completely opposed to the sanctions. And there is a steadily growing, especially among the youth, you know, understanding that this is, you know, this, I wouldn't say that it's irrational, because that concedes that it's, you know, not in the interest of the imperialists in this country. Of course, they want to subjugate and isolate what is a thriving and remarkable, you know, socialist experiment and revolution that has done so much for the people. They don't want these you know, examples to thrive and become, you know, an inspiration for working people here on the island, or here in the empire, rather, the belly of the beast. But I think it's very clear that there is a, you know, unanimous, almost unanimous consensus among the global South that these are inhumane policies. And that has been especially clear, like you mentioned, with social media. I think it's become increasingly clear to the youth that the United States can't be taken as a moral arbiter, in huge part to those brave young Palestinian journalists who have implicated the U.S. and Israel as the perpetrators of the most widely documented genocide in human history at this point, and both of whom, the U.S. and Israel, have been the sole opposition to the nearly unanimous condemnation to those sanctions in Cuba at consecutive U.N. General Assemblies since 1992. And so there's so many different arguments that can be made, you know, to the right-wing exile community. If Cuba is the undemocratic authoritarian hellscape that they try to make it out to be within the propaganda, then it is of no benefit to continue these sanctions. It is of benefit to both the Cuban diaspora and the Cuban people to allow for the government to do what it can do unmitigatedly, and therefore remove that so-called excuse of the sanctions that the government, you know, performs to the people. These are not excuses. They're among the pro-bloqueo, which is interesting. Among the pro-bloqueo diaspora, there are some people that don't believe the embargo exists. And so this is the kind of you know, this is a kind of the role that we must play as young Cubans, as young socialists, to really push back against the media apparatus that is trying to manufacture consent among the next generation of people, to say that this is the way that it should be, that it is for the benefit of democracy and human rights to be able to impose what the Mallory document by the CIA has very clearly, explicitly stated was for the you know, the aims of overthrowing or causing regime change. And, you know, from my own perspective, I came to the conclusion from studying and becoming first and foremost an anti-capitalist, understanding that the role that the U.S. has played in foreign policy is not just something that is exhibited on Cuba, but, you know, this regime change foreign policy has victimized the global South in its entirety. And I think that anybody who is conscious of that will have doubts, and those doubts are stirring due to the important role of social media among the young Cuban community. And I think that one thing I'd like to propose or mention is some data points from my university that is pretty insightful. FIU's Cuban Research Institute, they had a survey in 2022 in which 1,000 Cuban American Miami-Dade County residents were surveyed. And right now, 1.2 million Cuban Americans in Miami. At the time, it was 955,000. But on the questions of whether the sanctions have been affected, 71% of the respondents that were from 18 to 39 years old said no. What's interesting is that among that same young demographic, the question of favoring the continuation of the sanctions, it was 44% were opposed or strongly opposed. So that's a little bit of a distinction, but compared to the older, the 60-year-old and above members of the diaspora, they favored the sanctions by 65%. So there's a shift there, right? The argument can be made that there is a whole new generation who's seeing, you know, these, you know, the hypocrisy of these policies. But more so, I think one of the things that we should get from this information is that there is, of the total amount surveyed, 37% that opposed the embargo. Now that, if, you know, proportional to the entirety of Miami-Dade County, would come out to about 353,000 people that are capable of being mobilized, that are capable of learning and going to, you know, through the struggles, through the practice of fighting against it, having these political homes like our chapter or the coalitions that we're seeking to unite, to be able to have more consciousness, not only on how the sanctions have affected the people, but on the remarkable struggle and construction of socialism that is currently ongoing. And I think that it is through that fight, through the demand of ending the U.S. blockade and ending the state sponsors of terrorism designation, that we're capable of building a movement, not only across the nation, but even in the most, you know, reactionary elements, to really call out that hypocrisy, not only of U.S. imperialist policy, but among, you know, the more conservative diaspora members. And so, yeah, there was one more thing that I think was really impactful from that survey. It goes into how the terms, the presidential terms of Obama, and then when Trump took office, how it affected people's perceptions. When he introduced those important and popular reforms in the last years in his second term, the number of Cubans who opposed the blockade rose from 54% in 2012 to 72% in 2016. So even these diplomatic, or at least attempts to create diplomatic relations, had a significant impact among that right-wing Cuban community that's tried to encapsulate that narrative of being pro-sanctions, of trying to maintain them through the pressures that they have put forward. Even those 2 years, or rather 4 years, of diplomatic relations, or the intentions to continue that, you know, as much as we can expect the Obama administration and to be able to do, it still had a huge shift in political perception of how we are to orient and relate to the Cuban people, to the Cuban government, for the benefit of our respective countries. Now, the benefit of, you know, the president or whatever the establishment considers to be the benefit would be, you know, a sort of liberalization, a neoliberal sort of free market transactional relationship. However, we know that allowing the Cuban people to thrive, allowing the Cuban system to thrive, like I had mentioned, is going to be, you know, an example, a beacon within the Caribbean and internationally for how we can expand democracy, how we can struggle against exploitation within the empire, and ultimately take a meaningful blow towards imperialism and capitalism on the world stage. So I think that it's incredibly important that we do not get demoralized in terms of the youth. The youth are killing it, and we're going to continue to propagate this and ensure that we do reach those masses of people who are sympathetic and ultimately willing to get into struggle and make those connections between how, you know, Cuba policy is, you know, very similar to how we orient towards Palestine, how we orient towards Venezuela, and how this is part of a larger capitalist imperialist system that we must unite as an international working class to overthrow.
That was excellent, Oscar. Thank you. Thank you for touching on a few things, not just, you know, Cuba's portrayal on and how they've, how the, you know, Washington and the State Department has kind of shaped the narrative there, and just the sanctions and the blockade existing against Cuba because of the threat that they pose to the U.S. and not just what they could be, but what they have accomplished. And them, you know, being a threat against the political agenda of global capitalism. And I'm hopeful that in places like Miami-Dade County, we get some more, you know, and encouraging, or I guess I should say encouraging numbers as far as Cuban Americans that are supportive of overthrowing the blockade there. So thank you very much. Dr. Nimes, I wanted to direct this question towards you. Cuba has historically facilitated or partnered in the proliferation of a Pan-African liberation politic. How has Cuba's relationship with Black Americans and African nations, based on gestures of solidarity like sending troops to Angola in the fight against apartheid or meeting with Malcolm X at the Teresa Hotel in Harlem, shaped today's global solidarity networks throughout various justice movements?
Before answering that question, I just wanted to underscore a number of the things that Oscar said, which are extremely important to understand why there is a blockade, why the sanctions exist. They exist, they are part of Washington's effort to make life as difficult as possible for the Cuban people, with the hope that they will rise up one day and overthrow their revolution. That's the purpose of the blockade, make life as difficult for the Cuban people as possible. And you might ask, well, why do they want to overthrow a revolution? The revolution is a threat. Let's be clear, though, let's be specific about that threat. The last thing that Washington wants is for the working class in the United States is to know about what the working class in Cuba has done. That's what they really fear. They fear their own working class. And that they to hear about what's going on in Cuba and how indeed you can actually have a government for the first time that serves the interests of the working class and not just the elite. That's the fear. That's the thing that they hate the most. That's what they want to make sure that we don't learn about. And that's why we have to do everything we can to teach the truth about Cuba, especially our fellow workers. But that's important. And I think it parallels very much what Helen outlined about the support within Cuba and how Cuba organizes to defend itself. That's what Washington is trying to break the spirit of the Cuban people, because it's a threat. It's a threat because the last thing, again, they want is for the working class in this country, a working class that's increasingly under pressure. The standard of living of working people. Think about what's been going on. Think about your generation and the fact that you are not likely to experience the same standard of living as your parents. The realization of the fact that the best that capitalism has to offer the working class, that's behind us. That's behind us. And this is what Washington knows. That's the fear. That's what they're afraid about. On the question about Cuba solidarity, African Americans, and so on, that, yes, from the very beginning, Malcolm X and his meeting with Fidel Castro in 1960 at the Teresa Hotel. I'm convinced. I went back and looked at some of those discussions and so on. I think, That was the beginning of Malcolm X's reconsidering the question of Caucasians and white people. Because he had to deal with, he admits it, he had to deal with this problem. There's a white man who's a revolutionary. Yeah, he's got to figure this out and think about it and so on. And I think that's the beginning of his, what would later emerge in 1964 after that second trip to Mecca, and where Malcolm reconsiders the question of race. But I really think it begins with the Cuban Revolution. One of the mistakes, misconceptions about the ending of apartheid in South Africa is that is somehow the work we did around boycott, divestment, and sanctions and so on, that it was, that was crucial. I'd like to believe that, but that's not true. It's not true. What was decisive in the overthrow of apartheid was the mass uprisings that were taking place within South Africa, the mass uprising, and complemented by that defeat that the Cubans inflicted on the South African army in Angola in the spring of 1988. Again, the mass uprisings that were taking place in the late 1980s in South Africa, combined with that defeat, that military defeat that South Africa suffered at the hands of the Cubans in a place called, small little town in Angola called Cuito Cuanavale. And that was in the spring of 1988. Fidel Castro accurately predicted, after that defeat, after that victory, Fidel Castro predicted that apartheid would come to an end. That was his prediction. And indeed, that's exactly what happened, because what the that defeat is what forced the South African regime to the negotiating table for the first time. Up until then, they had been avoiding any kinds of serious discussions and so on. But that defeat was crucial. The biggest victory of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement was achieved in 1986. And that's when Congress overrode a veto. Congress had passed a bill calling for sanctions, divestment against South Africa. That was passed in 1986. Reagan vetoed that bill by Congress. Congress overrode the veto. That was a big deal. Big deal. Never happened to the Reagan administration. The Congress overrode the veto. But nothing changed in South Africa until 2 years later with the victory at Cuito Cuanavale. So it's very important to understand, I think the most important thing we did was to make it difficult for Washington to be openly supportive of the South African apartheid regime. I think that's what the movement did. But we shouldn't confuse it, though. We shouldn't confuse it with the actual overthrow of apartheid. That begins with the military victory of the Cubans over the South Africans in the spring of 1988 at a small little town in Angola called Cuito Cuanavale. And so that's perhaps, in my opinion, the most important thing to think about in terms of the future and the kinds in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution. And African Americans were in the vanguard, played in a vanguard role in 1959, 1960, going to Cuba, coming back and telling us about the realities within Cuba. And then what Cuba later did within Africa solidified that support. And the future of the Cuban Revolution, in my opinion, will depend upon that kind of solidarity in the United States amongst working class of all skin colors. And that's something that we have to soberly think about in terms of the defending and the continuation of the Cuban Revolution.
Amazing. Thank you, Dr. Nimes. Yes. Dr. Yaffe, I know a lot has been discussed on the kind of just devastating impact of the blockade and continuing sanctions, so I wanted to pose this one to you. What does the U.S. gain by continuing sanctions that were designed in the Cold War era, and how could the U.S. benefit by restoring positive relations with Cuba and other countries in the Global South, particularly regarding Cuba's medical innovations?
Yeah, so, I mean, these we've been touching on these questions, and what I'm going to say kind of in answer to that links with points previously made. The point is, you know, what sanctions are supposed to be a punishment for something. And so the argument is, oh, well, Cuba nationalized US-owned properties and they didn't take compensation. In fact, they were offered compensation, but they were advised not to take it because, of course, the US administration was already planning the Bay of Pigs invasion or Playa Girón, and they didn't want to legitimize something that could afterwards be reversed anyway. So that, but you know, actually, the Oscar mentioned Lester Mallory's memorandum, which basically frames and sets out the US policy on Cuba. And that memorandum was written before most nationalizations had taken place, and it was very clear. It said, what we notice in Cuba is that the government of the revolutionary government is extremely popular, and we're not going to stand much chance of building an internal opposition unless we take these measures and we unleash economic warfare against the Cuban population to make them desperate, miserable, and to rise up and overthrow their government. So, you know, the question is not about what they can gain. It's like the fear that the United States has. And I think... it's been very well expressed, right? It is the fear of the threat of a good example. And August talks about in relation to what that says to the US working class, right? You know, you're told we don't have money for a public healthcare system, but here's this tiny little island, you know, after hundreds of years of colonialism and imperialism. And within one generation, they had human development indicators that were, that could equal the advanced capitalist countries that have been the beneficiaries of that global system of exploitation. But I'd go further. It's not just Cuba's example for the US working class. It is the example for the oppressed or colonized part of the world. Because when the Cuban Revolution comes along, I talked about the importance of sovereignty, and sovereignty meaning real control over your natural resources, right? And that means kicking the US investors out, kicking out the mining companies and the oil companies and the extractivism. That basically is destroying the environment, wrecking people's lives, loot and plunder. And, you know, what does that tell for the rest of the global south, the other oppressed countries, about, you know, actually, we don't need to have this dependent relationship where the only way we can get capital, like finance or technology, is from the rich countries. But we have to expose, you know, open ourselves up to exploitation, extractivism, with all the terrible side effects of that. So it's that threat as well. But I mean, I teach a course on Cuba, and we go through the different sort of sectors, and then we look at the statistics. You know, what was infant mortality before the revolution, you know, similar to Haiti today? And what is it now? Well, it's unfortunately gone down in the last 3 years because of the economic crisis, which shows the direct link. It shows how genocidal the US blockade has become. But, you know, we can see extraordinary things. Cuba has more doctors per person than anywhere in the world, three times more than the United States. In the United States, you know, you cannot provide, like, even in Britain, we have a basic national public healthcare system. In the US, you know, possibly still the richest country in the world. And your people, the population is told that that's not possible, or it's not efficient, or it's not, you know, forget it. So, you know, what Cuba has done, the fact that Cuba was the only country in the whole of Latin America and the Caribbean to develop a COVID-19 vaccine. And to do it almost as quickly as these huge, big billion-dollar biotech super corporations, which were using, you know, new untested technology, and which has proven, by the way, to still have an incredible efficacy up above 90%, while the vaccines that I imagine we all received, you know, have fallen and fallen in efficacy. And, you know, we were talking about August was talking about Cuba's contribution to Angola. I mean, but actually, we could have talked about Cuba's contribution to any of the countries in Africa, because that's the reality. The Cubans, whether they were soldiers fighting to support national liberation, to help secure post-colonial new revolutionary governments, or whether they were medics who run healthcare clinics in a vast majority of countries in Africa. You know, it is phenomenal. But what it has done, right? I mean, Cuba in Africa, as Piero Iglesias, who has done, you know, just outstanding research, archival research in Washington, in Moscow, in Havana, about the reality of that intervention. And he said Cuba was the only, the term he uses, third world country ever to project beyond its own neighborhood, right? And it did that against an apartheid, a racist regime. But you know, what it has done for the US is it's actually created a massive obstacle to their imperialist plans and intentions. And the US has had, you know, it has its policy in various parts of the world. And there are the Cubans in international forums denouncing the US funding for repressive regimes in Central America, which are killing, you know, particularly indigenous communities. There is Cuba in international communities vociferously defending the independence of Puerto Rico or Western Sahara, you know, and there is Cuba, unbelievably principled, constantly defending the right of the Palestinian people. So, you know, it's a terrible thorn in the side, and it's a threat of a good example. On the other hand, implicit in the question is that, you know, there is something that the US loses out. And that's undoubted, because the United States, not the government, but the population, the people of the US, they undoubtedly lose quite significantly for some people from not being able to relate to Cuba, to import Cuba's medical, products, to not be able to enter into cultural, scientific and so on exchanges. And, you know, perfect example is the the diabetes drug that Cuba has, right? Diabetes is one of the big ailments and killers in the United States, right? And as I understand it, something like 500,000 people have to be amputated every year in the United States because they get diabetic foot ulcers. And, you know, the death rate is extremely high. But Cuba has a product which reduces the need for amputations by over 70%. And that would save over 50,000 people in the United States who are currently facing amputations. Now, extend that around the world and then add that, you know, Cuba was the first country in the world to eliminate mother-to-child HIV transition. It was the first country to come up with a lung cancer vaccination based on immunology. It has the COVID vaccine. It has meningitis vaccines, which are, you know, and the basis of Cuba's medical science system is to provide medicine. It's antithetical to the US privatized, commodified healthcare system, but is to provide treatment that is available in, you know, mountaintop clinics, that is cheap, and that uses, you know, they use it in immunology a lot because it doesn't require very expensive, sophisticated medical technology, which requires hospitalization and so on. So, you know, there are undoubtedly millions of people in the United States who are losing out today because of the US blockade against Cuba. And, you know, that's just talking about the richest, possibly the richest country in the world, the United States. Let's also talk about the people around the world. I wrote recently, I think last year, an article about Cuban medical internationalism. And there is a Guatemalan researcher, Henry Morales, who has done some really interesting work looking at, you know, what is known of the statistics of how many medics have gone overseas from Cuba to provide treatment, which is free at the point of delivery. And then because the Cubans never talk about cost, right? They're very, you know, modest. They're not doing it for cost. They're doing it out of international solidarity. They're doing it because they have a concept that access to healthcare is a human right, and it's endorsed in their constitution. But he's gone through and he's given, like, using OECD statistics, he's given a cost evaluation to the amount of medical aid that Cuba has provided overseas. And he's used a period from, I think, 1995 to 2015. And what he demonstrates is it's a huge amount of money for a country with such a small GDP, that it's equivalent to 6.6% of Cuba's GDP on average over that period. How does that compare to the United States, which presents itself as extremely generous? The US is something like 0.19%. The European average is slightly more. But, you know, the Cubans are donating something like 10 times more to the rest as a percent of their GDP than the richest countries in the world. And in fact, what that amounts to, according to his statistics, is 4 to 5 billion a year that Cuba contributes, which is what the US blockade is currently costing Cuba every year. So, you know, we can also extrapolate from that. If Cuba didn't face this damaging, the cost, the drain of US sanctions on a yearly basis, it could potentially double its international overseas development assistance. So the whole world is actually losing out. The vast majority of countries are underdeveloped countries. The vast majority are in what's called the global south. They've been underdeveloped by colonialism and imperialism. And those are the countries where Cuba is providing medical care for people who would otherwise not be able to receive anything. I'll stop there.
Yeah, thank you for that, Dr. Yaffe, and for touching on the issue of medical internationalism and diplomacy and gestures of solidarity that Cuba has shown throughout their revolutionary process and the principles that they've shown in deploying medical professionals throughout the world, including to the U.S. following Hurricane Katrina, in which President Bush had rebuffed it, showing, you know, really the commitment to suffering that Cuba has stuck to in the moral bankruptcy of the U.S. So I thank you for touching on that. Oscar, I wanted to ask you this question. I know you've kind of touched on this a lot in your previous answer, but just kind of following up, what are your feelings on the notion that the Washington Consensus takes their political approach to Cuba based on that outspoken right-wing exile community in Miami? And how does this circumstance reverberate to the social political conditions in Cuba? For context, ACEDE reports that migration of 600,000 Cubans from the island since 2021, with some media outlets in the U.S. reporting as many as a million, which is about 10% of the population on the island. And what does this mean to the future of Cuba's Revolutionary Party?
Yeah, I appreciate this question, because it's definitely a very popular framing to make it seem, you know, that this right-wing exile community is kind of holding these politicians towards the democratic mandate, like this monolithic, you know, acceptance and consent towards these policies. But I think that it's ultimately misguided, because it misrepresents why and how these sanctions have been maintained, and most critically, how we can fight to eliminate them. I think that as socialists, we need to understand that these inhumane policies are not democratic mandates on behalf of the Cuban community. They are imposed upon the Cuban community in direct alignment with the interests of capital, of the imperialists. The tail does not wag the dog, so to speak. So I think an analogy that's similar to how this identitarian facade is being implemented as we speak is within the Jewish community. We know all too well that the Zionist genocidal policy that we've been implementing, that we've been supporting, although representing a steadily decreasing but still large proportion of Jewish Americans and many more Christian Americans as well that consider themselves Zionists, it's not truly being imposed, as a democratic mandate. Its imperial aims, of course, are to expand military influence in the region, as well as the extraction of land and oil in the Gaza Strip. And we know that this is a facade because of that steadily decreasing support for these policies among anti-Zionist Jewish students and organizations that the state has had no hesitancy to repress among our campuses, among and in the streets. And I think that that repression, without having to answer to the hypocrisy of their former arguments, stating that it is in the interest and security to support Israel, ultimately, as they take Judaism hostage to achieve these imperialist aims, I think it just gains more conviction in those stances and more animosity towards the duplicity of the state. And I think on a similar analogy with this myth that there is a conservative majority among the Cuban people, but to say that it is simply because that majority exists that they are bound to be representing that diaspora or that sentiment, I think is a bit misleading in terms, because we know that this is something that has steadily decreased among the youth, like I mentioned before. This is not an essentialist characteristic, although there is a cyclical process of how the media and the propaganda, especially one thing I forgot to mention in my previous account, attacks on academic freedom, especially in Florida. We've had DeSantis, who had imposed, with an already anti-communist sort of U.S. education system, has imposed a direct portion of middle schooling where they talk about the failures of communism, further instilling that ideological reproduction to demonize the Cuban government and any revolutionary movement. And it goes to show that there is pressure being put on the left by the students that are questioning these things for the necessity for such a policy to even be proposed. And so what I think is more so the case is that regardless of the intention or the success that we have in mobilizing this new generation of Cuban Americans towards being against the blockade, similar to what Jewish Voices for Peace saying, not in our name, towards these policies, that is an aim that I want to contribute to build or to continue to build within coalitions to be able to say that the Cuban community does not stand for this. But does that mean that the imperialist policy will suddenly be abolished, that the sanctions will be eliminated, that it won't be a state sponsor of terrorism designated country? I don't believe that that's all it will take. And I think that that's why it's really important as socialists that we continue to put forward these demands to move people into struggle, but that we are clear-sighted in our principles that this is not... this is not just a representative of, we don't live in a democracy. I don't believe that's the case. And so we have to understand that it's the bourgeoisie will impose, these sanctions for the very threats that the Cuban government poses towards them. I don't say that to undermine the reactionary elements within the Cuban diaspora. Like I mentioned, the pro-bloqueo exile community is an organized force. Their ruthless origins with coup attempts like the Bay of Pigs that have been CIA-funded, anti-Castro terrorist attacks that were committed by anti-Castro Cuban exiles that did not face a lick of justice whatsoever. They lived by the beach in Miami and didn't face a slap on the wrist for having, fulfilled or attempted to fulfill. Some of them were successful. Flight 455 was a notable, terrorist attack that has, still had reverberations in terms of how Cuba, responds and its hesitancy to maintain diplomatic relations. But of course, it is the imperialists themselves that have maintain this sort of sanctions. There are prominent figures and prominent leaders within the community among the pro-sanctioned diaspora that have exercised control within Congress to try to further maintain them. Maria Elvira Salazar is one of the newest generations coming from Miami who has been an outspoken, you know, Trump supporter, but also outspoken in terms of this facade of human rights and democracy as the intentions of the sanctions. But even with that control, that it is simply just an additional, you know, aid among the, you know, the respective demographic of Cubans to maintain those policies. Now, of course, these circumstances do reverberate towards the conditions in Cuba when you have, you know, genuine protests for economic shortage from these political crises on the island, and that has more attention than the sanctions that are placed. I think that the sanctions are never really are quite few like mentions and framings in terms of the actual, you know, circumstances on the island when there are protests going on, and you know that is consequential to how these sanctions are further imposed. You know, and it's quite ironic and it's quite unfortunate. So it does have significant, it does have significant danger to the conditions. It's still continuing to achieve that regime change, as its stated intentions. But we have to continue to push back on it. We have to continue to frame as independent journalist Belly of the Beast does in terms of really emphasizing the role of the sanctions in terms of the reporting on the conditions of the island, and really instilling that it's not simply just the, you know, an irrational policy, but one that is completely rational towards the interests of isolating this country and isolating the gains, like Helen Yaffe had mentioned, from working class people and oppressed people around the globe.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.